Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Now that you've had your recreation time, let's do a little bit of work. Here we are in our last day, so we probably ought to draw some conclusions and summaries from everything that we've done. So two of the things that we'd like to do today is talk about where there seems to be pretty wide agreement amongst macroeconomists, and also where there seems to be big room for disagreements as well. So the first thing that we can say is almost every macroeconomist is of the opinion that in the long run, there's no trade-off between unemployment and inflation. Right? So we saw that, in fact, in the way we set our model up, that became our long-run aggregate supply curve. So with our long-run aggregate supply curve, the economy was at potential output, regardless of what the rate of inflation was. We also had a long-run Phillips curve, which showed us exactly the same thing. So that this particular proposition is built into the model that we have been using. Now, of course, just the simple fact that we've built this relationship into the model does not necessarily mean that the relationship is true. However, there's lots of empirical evidence to suggest that, as our model does demonstrate, economies do, over longer periods of time, return to the natural rate of unemployment or potential output, regardless of what the inflation rate might be. So we've got both a theoretical basis as well as an empirical basis for widespread agreement on this particular topic. A second big conclusion where virtually everybody agrees is that, again, in the long run, inflation is really determined by the rate of growth of the money supply. That is that inflation is really the responsibility of the central bank in terms of its control of money, or the money supply, and therefore inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. Again, we've built that into our model, where what we've seen is that any changes in the money supply or in the monetary base after they work their way through the money multiplier will, in fact, shift the aggregate demand curve in the short run, but once the economy has worked through its full adjustment process, we will still get back to potential output, and all we have is a different level of inflation. So that money, changes in the money supply change the inflation rate, but in the long run, nothing else. So again, we can always suggest then that central banks, as the monetary authorities, have the ultimate control for what the inflation rate might be. A third general source of agreement is that price stability is quite beneficial to economies. And again, remember what we mean when we talk about price stability. So price stability, it does not mean that prices never change. It simply means that inflation is relatively low and relative. In fact, the issue or the result that comes about from that is that when inflation is relatively low and relatively stable, we will also have low and stable inflationary expectations. And as we discussed, if we have rational expectations, and inflationary expectations are very sticky in the sense that we expect inflation to be low and stable, then our short-run aggregate supply curve doesn't bounce around nearly as much as it would when we assume adaptive expectations. So you may remember in that one exam where we looked at Germany after a price shock that the short-run aggregate supply curve returns to its original position much, much more quickly. So low and stable inflation, which leads to low and stable expected inflation, will also have a tendency to minimize both the volatility in inflation as well as the volatility in economic output and unemployment. Again, not much disagreement about that. There is some disagreement about how big those effects are, how do we measure those benefits, but nothing to the extent that they aren't quite substantial. A fourth area of significant agreement is if we want to achieve price stability, low and stable inflation resulting in low and stable inflationary expectations, central banks must commit to following the Taylor Principle. And remember, the Taylor Principle simply says that if there is an increase in inflation, that we must also increase the real interest rate, or central banks must raise the nominal interest rate by more than the increase in the inflation rate. Now, this doesn't mean that at every squiggle on inflation that the central banks will always increase the real interest rate. There are other overriding factors. So, for instance, we know that if there's a negative short-run aggregate supply shock, short-run curve shifts up, right? So what do we end up with? We end up with higher inflation, and we also end up with a negative unemployment gap or output gap. So we also know that the way the economy's dynamics work, that it's likely that if that shock was not continued in subsequent time periods, that the inflation rate's going to slowly come back down because of our negative output gap. And therefore, the central bank, knowing that, is not necessarily going to raise the real interest rate along the MP curve, as evidenced by the Taylor Principle, but may actually decide to reduce the real interest rate as an exogenous policy change. So if you actually look at data and you say, well, let's look at inflation rates and the real policy interest rate, and everything ought to fall on an upward sloping monetary policy curve. It actually turns out that you're much more likely to see the data looking like it's downward sloping, not upward sloping. That's not to say that the Taylor Principle doesn't hold, nor is it to suggest that central banks never follow the Taylor Principle. What it says is that central banks actually move away from the Taylor Principle based on other economic considerations that are taking place at that period of time. But since most countries actually follow monetary policies to keep inflation relatively low and stable, it must mean that over time, central banks do indeed follow the Taylor Principle. Now, one of the ways that it makes it easier for central banks to follow the Taylor Principle and to lean against higher inflation or rising inflation and inflationary expectations is for central banks to be more independent of the political pressures that might arise within governments. So central banks that have a greater arm's length separation from elected politicians who may be populist in nature, allow central banks to undertake some of the difficult circumstances of raising real interest rates when inflation is threatening to get out of hand. Things that elected officials may or may not be willing to do, but central bankers not having to worry about facing the electorate might be much more willing to do that, or not facing pressures from elected officials. So, of course, this is part and parcel of the structure that we have at the American Federal Reserve Bank, where the Board of Governors have long terms in office, 14 years. The Fed's actually financed out of its own revenues, so it doesn't have to go to Congress for appropriations. So there's a whole set of reasons there that allow the Federal Reserve to be very independent of the kind of political pressures that might be coming from Congress or the administration. The European Central Bank, by the way, is set up very similar to the Federal Reserve, as is the Bank of Japan. So those banks can also follow or have a great deal of independence from politics. Some central banks don't, but the movement over the years has been for greater and greater independence within the government, but from those kinds of political pressures. Now, we know that in the execution of monetary and fiscal policy, we can lead to those time inconsistency problems that we discussed a while back. So remember, what a time inconsistency problem basically tells us is the kind of policy that we might undertake in the short run to alleviate a short-run problem might actually aggravate a long-run outcome. So we know, for instance, that if there's a negative short-run aggregate supply shock, the unemployment rate will rise. One of the things that we might do under that circumstance is to have a positive aggregate demand shock with either a stimulative monetary and or fiscal policy, shifting the aggregate demand curve to the right. That will have the effect of bringing the unemployment rate down more quickly, but it also has the effect of making a permanent increase in the inflation rate. So if we think about getting back to the natural rate of unemployment through the economy self-adjustment mechanism, which would also get us back to the same inflation rate, we now have a worse outcome in the long run, although we've had a better outcome in the short run. So those kinds of issues about short run versus long run outcomes is the timing consistency problem and something that policymakers need to be aware of when, in fact, they are implementing monetary and fiscal policy changes. By the way, not all monetary and fiscal policy changes actually lead to time inconsistency problems. But when you execute a monetary or fiscal policy in the short run, one has to be aware of its long-run consequences and needs to make provisions for either offsetting or augmenting those policies to achieve the right kind of long-run goals. As we also talked about and saw in our models, especially when we looked at the difference between our standard model based on a one-period adaptive expectations and models based on rational expectations, the way in which expectations are actually formed can be very important to the types of outcomes that we are likely to see. It can determine how long the adjustment process might be. It can also determine what those outcomes might be. So expectations can be very, very important in the implementation of monetary and fiscal policy. One of the most difficult things to actually try to understand in terms of how expectations are formed is what happens when monetary or fiscal policy has to do something relatively extraordinary to deal with quite unusual economic circumstances. So if we thought about the last 5 or 6 years and the kind of recession that the economy had and weak economic recovery that we've had, how do expectations begin to change when the central bank triples the size of its balance sheet and the velocity of money has collapsed so that the money multiplier has gone down a lot? We know that the monetary base is much, much bigger than it had been prior to the Great Recession, but we also know the money supply hasn't grown very quickly. So how do people think about that? Do they think about that as laying lots of dry tinder on the ground that could spark a hyperinflation or at least a sharply higher inflation rate? Or do they form their expectation in the way that the Federal Reserve will be responsible enough to start pulling that excess monetary base out of the system once monetary velocity begins to accelerate again? We don't know. We haven't been through these kinds of circumstances very often. So far, it looks like expectations haven't changed much at all. But does that mean that a year from now or 2 years from now, if the economy begins to accelerate, then inflation, those expectations won't change? There's a similar issue with fiscal policy. We're running huge budget deficits at the current time period, in part because we have a very significant economic shortfall relative to potential. So the negative output gap is still quite substantial, which means that tax revenues have been depressed, which means that the budget deficit is going to be much wider than one would expect at full employment. With a very large budget deficit, it also means that the debt to GDP ratio is rising, and in fact rising quite quickly. We also know that there's at some point lenders, especially if you're borrowing from foreigners, will become increasingly worried about financing even more debt that your government is issuing. But where exactly is that tipping point? When do those expectations change? For Greece, they changed 3 years ago. For the United States and the UK and Japan, all countries with fairly substantial debt to GDP ratios, and all countries with very large budget deficits, it hasn't happened yet. But that doesn't mean it won't happen. But knowing when and what the orders of magnitude are can make a huge difference. And so this whole notion of expectations, both about how the economy is going to perform and how monetary and policy decisions will affect economic outcomes, becomes very, very important. When setting monetary and or fiscal policy, the credibility of the policymakers is also very important here. So here we want to make sure that we have policymakers who are transparent about what their short-term goals as well as their long-term goals are. This is true both for monetary policy as well as fiscal policy. So here on the monetary policy side, it seems like in the United States, the Federal Reserve still has a great deal of credibility, both about their short-term goals, where they continue to say that we will keep the current level of stimulus, that is, very low short-term interest rates, in the economy for a long period of time until the economy actually begins to grow at a somewhat faster pace than what we've seen recently, and the unemployment rate comes down. But the credibility is also important in a long-term sense, because most people still seem to believe that the Federal Reserve has a long-term commitment, credible commitment, to maintaining inflation at around 2%. If they lose that credibility of maintaining inflation around 2%, things could change quite significantly. So notice again, we've got a time inconsistency issue. What the central bank is doing in the short run may be very inconsistent with its long-run goals. But if it has both short-run and long-run credibility about what it's attempting to do, then, of course, the situation can be, we can have a much better outcome. This also works very well on the fiscal policy side. If you're really, really, really scared that the Congress and the administration, either the current one or whichever will be in place early next year, has absolutely no chance of dealing with our long-run budget deficit situations, then you're going to have a very different kind of expectation about what might happen than if, in fact, there is some credibility there that Congress and the administrations will begin to deal with those long-run issues. And that makes a huge difference in terms of how cheap or expensive it is to finance budget deficits. So if you looked at most of the peripheral European countries, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, all of those countries have what we call very significant structural deficits. That structural deficit means how big would the budget deficit be even if the economy was at full employment? And for all of those Southern European and countries as well as Ireland, those structural budget deficits appear to be very substantial, and substantial enough that there's no way that those countries can actually work themselves out of that debt situation. And as an investor, once you recognize those kinds of conditions, you don't want to lend those countries, companies, individuals, it's not just countries that fall into this category, any more money. But on the other hand, if your structural budget deficit isn't so substantial, that there are policy options that are available in terms of both reducing government spending and increasing taxes, or other types of policies that might, for instance, promote the greater growth of total factor productivity so the economy would grow more quickly, then in those circumstances, that credibility helps a country to minimize its overall borrowing costs. And again, we're seeing that in countries like Japan, which actually has a debt-to-GDP ratio that's much worse than what we see in Greece, even before the restructuring of the Greek debt. We also see that in Great Britain or the UK, which also has a budget, both budget deficits and debt to GDP ratios higher than the United States. And the UK just announced yesterday that they're back in recession again. So that doesn't help very much in terms of trying to deal with the situation. And if we looked at a country like Spain or Italy, where the interest rates are beginning to creep up, again, there's some issue about the credibility. Part of that is the credibility of being able to deal with their debt situation in a timely and significant way. So credibility can be very important, both on a monetary and a fiscal policy side. Especially for monetary policy, nominal anchors can be very important. That is, when we think about how we want to establish a monetary policy regime, in a short run or an intermediate or even a long run sense, having some sort of nominal anchor, whether it's an exchange rate, whether it's an inflation rate, whether it's a money supply growth rate, whether it's a nominal GDP growth rate, that those nominal anchors help to both commit the central bank to a longer run goal, which helps with its credibility, but it also helps with the time inconsistency issue, that any movement away from the nominal anchor in the short run will be reversed when we get to the long run, so that our time inconsistency problem actually disappears. So nominal anchors can be very, very important. As we, as I mentioned earlier about the benefits of price stability and having credibility in the way expectations are formed, adopting a nominal anchor also helps the central bank to minimize the volatility and inflation, as well as economic output and unemployment. Now, one other aspect that almost everybody agrees with is that within the context of long-term economic growth, now our models always said, let's look at total factor productivity. And total factor productivity is by far and away the most important factor. But the other thing that economic historians and growth economists have looked at is, do countries have the right set of institutions to actually allow for more rapid growth and total factor productivity to actually take place? And so we've seen this over and over again. In fact, there's a new book out called Why Nations Fail that actually points out that those countries who haven't been very successful in launching their economic future is primarily because they don't have the right kind of institutions that are in the country. As we discussed earlier, sometimes that has to do with private property rights, which seems to be very, very important. But sometimes it has to do with the amount of corruption, whether or not the legal system can be viewed as fair and impartial, and a variety of other types of institutions that might exist in a country as well. So all of those things are, that gives us 10 things then that macroeconomists broadly agree on. Like I say, it's not to say that you couldn't find a macroeconomist out there that didn't disagree with one or more of these. But there are wackos in every profession, and so one should never base disagreement from a wacko on representing a significant disagreement. I would say of these 10, probably more than 90% of macroeconomists would agree with all 10 of them. So we're talking very, very high percentages. Now, that's not to say that macroeconomists agree on everything, and in fact, we don't. So, what are the things we disagree the most on? And so if we went down to the other extreme where the biggest disagreements are, the first is, how flexible are wages and prices? So remember, this has to do with what is the slope of the short-run aggregate supply curve, right? Or another way of saying how flexible are wages and prices, we could actually ask ourselves, how sticky are wages and prices? And That becomes very important. As we saw, depending upon how flexible or sticky wages and prices are, has a great deal to do with how rapid the self-adjustment process of the economy actually is. When we get knocked out of general equilibrium, how fast do we get back to it? So that's part and parcel of wage and price stickiness. A subset of wage and price stickiness is, do we have asymmetries between wages and prices rising and wages and prices falling? Again, it's part of the same question, but there are disagreements about whether we have those asymmetries. People who think that wages and prices are fairly sticky also believe we have what are known as nominal wage and price rigidities. Nominal wage and price rigidities. That is, it's hard to reduce nominal wages. It's hard to get companies on a broad basis to cut prices. So those nominal wage and price rigidities means that we would have a very asymmetrical kind of outcome. And that also suggests then that the way our model works is very different in the way whether we have a negative output gap or a positive output gap. So for any given degree of wage and price flexibility, other than perfectly flexible wages and prices, we can also disagree on how long it takes to get to the long run. Now, this is often not a discussion about how flexible wages and prices are, but rather disagreements over what the data actually show us. So as an example, in December of 2007, the unemployment rate was 4.9%. We saw the unemployment rate rise to 10.1%, and now we're down to 8.2%. Are we in the long run yet? Well, I see some of you shake your heads no. But in fact, there's a whole bunch of macroeconomists who would say, yes, we are. What we've had is a negative long-run aggregate demand shock. And in fact, the long-run aggregate supply curve has shifted to the left, and 8.2 is pretty close to being general equilibrium. That kind of thought doesn't resonate with me very well, but that would suggest that we've already gotten back to the long run. A more Keynesian economist, or one who doesn't look at long-run aggregate demand shocks as occurring very frequently, would say, no, we still have a big negative output gap, and therefore we're not anywhere close to the long-run equilibrium. We can make the same argument about the period of the 1930s. In 1929, the unemployment rate was 2.9%. In 1933, it was about 25%. In 1941, it was still 12%. So were we in long-run equilibrium during any of that period of time? Standard Keynesian analysis would suggest, no, we had a big negative output shock. But a real business cycle analysis would say, well, not so fast. Maybe we had a long-run aggregate supply shock. And the natural rate of unemployment was no longer something like 3 or 4 or 5%. It was something much closer to 10 or 12 or 14%. So these kinds of arguments have been going on for a great deal of time. Now, one of the things that's interesting about these kinds of arguments is you would think that we would have data that would actually be able to prove one of these hypotheses correct and the other one incorrect. But in fact, the data that we have is not so pure that we can actually distinguish different hypotheses like these from one another. In fact, we'll probably never have data that's good enough to distinguish these hypotheses from another, which is bad news for people who are after the truth, but really good news for people who want to argue about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, or whether a real business cycle theory or Keynesian theory is the right model for the economy. These two arguments, though, that is, the argument about wage and price stickiness, as well as how long does it get to the, how long does it take to get to the long run, are also part and parcel of an argument about what is the actual source of business cycle fluctuations. Now, as we've discussed them here, and what our model primarily shows is that most business cycle fluctuations are actually the result of either aggregate demand shocks or short-run aggregate supply shocks. But there is a school of thought that that in fact most business cycle fluctuations are long-run aggregate supply shocks, and that they occur much, much more frequently than what we've discussed in this class. And this has important implications. Again, if the data is not sufficiently robust to be able to confirm or deny one of these hypotheses, then we don't know which is the true underlying model of the economy. And the policy response would be very different depending upon which of these two models that you actually believed. So if you thought about most of the shocks to the economy coming from the aggregate demand side, or for that matter, the short-run aggregate supply side, then the kind of monetary and fiscal policy actions that we've talked about during the course would be the kinds of things that would take place in important circles in Washington, D.C. and other national capitals. However, if you actually believe that most of the shocks to the economy were total factor productivity shocks that came from the long-run aggregate supply curve, now the policy discussion you would have should be very, very different. The outcomes are going to the outcome of the debate about what kind of policy changes to make would give you very different economic outcomes as well. Now, a fourth source of disagreement is how effective is stabilization policy? That is, should we even bother using monetary and/or fiscal policy to stabilize the economy? Now, part of this argument is a theoretical argument, a difference between the way Keynesians and classical economists viewed the world. And it has to do, quite frankly, with how flexible wages and prices are and how symmetrical or asymmetrical that flexibility is. So remember, what we've seen in our models is that if wages and prices are very flexible and symmetric up and down, that also should tell us that business cycles should be very short, that the economy should return to general equilibrium very, very quickly, in which case there would not be much of a reason for changes in either monetary or fiscal policy. A Keynesian who believes that wages and prices are much more sticky would argue that, in fact, the deviations from potential output and the natural rate of unemployment can be quite substantial and, indeed, can last for a very long period of time. In which case, an argument can be made for using monetary and fiscal policy to try to get the economy back to potential output and the natural rate of unemployment more quickly than the economy's automatic adjustment mechanism would take it. So that's the standard Keynesian analysis. But even within the Keynesian analysis, there's disagreements about what should happen. There are a number of Keynesians who would argue that business cycles, especially in the post-World War II period, have, except for the most recent experience, been relatively short, and the economy has reattained its previous peak level of economic output in a matter of two or three quarters. And if the economic downturns are going to be relatively short and mild, and the economic recoveries are going to occur very quickly, why do we need to bother to change monetary or fiscal policy in that kind of environment? So notice that that's not saying that wages and prices aren't sticky. We can still have very sticky wages and prices. It just says that these deviations, when we knock the economy off general equilibrium, we're just not knocking it off very far. And therefore, we don't really need to do all that much about it. But there are other arguments that can be made as well. And one of the arguments is time lags. You may remember when we talked about time lags, one of the things that we pointed out is when you decide to change monetary or fiscal policy, it does not have an instantaneous effect on the economy. And in fact, it may take a long time before there's actually an effect on the economy, and that may actually take place when the economy is already beginning to grow very rapidly again. So rather than being counter-cyclical policy, you might actually have pro-cyclical stabilization policy. There's some other arguments against fiscal policy as well. Again, even if you're a Keynesian, one of the arguments that you might make against fiscal policy is that most fiscal stimulus is what we refer to as non-reversible, or at least has very little probability of being reversed. It's very easy to increase government spending to stimulate the economy. It's very easy to cut taxes to stimulate the economy. But politically, it's very difficult to cut government spending or to raise taxes. And if you don't think so, all you have to do is think about the current debate that's going on, not only in Washington, but also all over the world. Now, what we also see, though, is that monetary policy has more flexibility. It's much easier to reverse. It's pretty easy for central banks to reduce the policy interest rate, but to the extent that the central bank is relatively independent from political pressures, central banks also find it much easier, not easy, but easier to raise interest rates when the need comes. And of course, notice that if you're going to follow the Taylor principle, you have to be reversible in terms of monetary policy. So how effective a stabilization policy has less to do with the theoretical framework of a Keynesian versus a classical economist than it might do with a lot of the technical aspects of stabilization policy as well. Now, earlier we had I had argued that there are major benefits to price stability, that is, maintaining low and stable inflation rates and therefore low and stable expected inflation. So if inflation isn't low and stable, it's viewed as being too high, whatever that might be, then the question that we also have to ask ourselves is, what are the costs associated with reducing inflation? If inflation were 10% and we wanted to bring it to 5%, or if it were 8 and we wanted to bring it to 4, in the context of our model, we know how to do that. We have to have a negative output gap, right? If we have a negative output gap, part of the cost of bringing inflation down is the fact that the unemployment rate's going to go up. Economic output will have been reduced. Economic output that could have been produced, but probably never will be. So these are real costs to the economy. People have lost their jobs. That means they've also lost their earned income. Businesses have lost sales and therefore profits. Governments have lost tax revenues. So we have to think about what those costs are and have a trade-off of some sort with the benefits of having low and stable inflation. A sixth area of disagreement, although this seems to be less of an issue today than it was 5 years ago, is how dangerous are big budget deficits? Now, we've seen in some countries, again, the European peripheral countries, where very large budget deficits and rapidly rising debt to GDP ratios have turned very, very nasty, where countries have basically been shut out of the international capital markets. They've had to pay very high interest rates to borrow money. And without the ability to borrow money, they've had to engage in very severe fiscal austerity measures, cutting government spending and raising taxes. So clearly there's some tipping point at which budget deficits can get too big and can be quite detrimental to the overall economy. But knowing how big is too big and when that tipping point might come is incredibly difficult to know. So in the United States today, we actually have people arguing that despite a rising debt to GDP ratio and a very large budget deficits, that we need to have not fiscal austerity, but more stimulus. We need to have monetary and fiscal stimulus in a way that'll help to bring the unemployment rate down much more quickly. In the UK, which by the way has about the same size budget deficit as a percent of the economy, has a somewhat higher debt to GDP ratio, but actually has about the same borrowing cost in the world, and as their 10-year treasury gilt notes versus our 10-year treasuries yield about the same, roughly 2%, give or take a little bit. They've come to a very, very different conclusion. Their conclusion is, we can't wait for more fiscal, for the economy to improve. We can't wait for the budget situation to take care of itself. We need to impose fiscal austerity right now. So they've gone through a significant period of time of cutting government purchases and raising selected taxes. And as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, we're growing, not rapidly, but the U.S. economy is growing, and the U.K. has just gone back into recession. In fact, the U.K., which is doing fiscal austerity with many of the same fiscal conditions that the U.S. has actually had an economic recovery since the recession of 2008 that is weaker than what they experienced in the 1930s. So the unemployment rate's not as high, but the economy itself is not doing particularly well. Okay, and the final big area of disagreement has to do with trade deficits. How dangerous are very, very big trade deficits? Now, one of the things that we know is that if trade deficits and internet, remember, a trade deficit also means that you're borrowing from the rest of the world. Part of the danger depends upon whether that borrowing from the rest of the world gets to be done in your own currency, like the United States. 98% of all international borrowing by American companies and the U.S. government are done in U.S. dollar terms. Or are you actually having to borrow in somebody else's currency? So if you looked at Argentina during the 1990s, if you looked at Thailand in the 1990s, almost all of their international borrowing from their trade deficits was actually done in other currencies, the U.S. dollar, the British pound, the German Deutschmark, the Japanese yen, rather than their own currencies. We know that when you borrow in another currency, you're also taking on foreign exchange risk, and that can lead to very nasty outcomes. But if we thought about a country like the United States, which has very, very large budget deficits trade deficits that are rising as a percent of GDP, and therefore we're issuing more and more foreigners are acquiring more and more dollar-denominated assets, then we have to think about whether or not this makes sense in terms of is there a point at which the rest of the world doesn't want to lend to us anymore? So it's not necessarily anything to do with budget deficits, but it might even just be a portfolio allocation issue. Right? How many U.S. dollars does the People's Bank of China really want to hold? Have $3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves right now. Probably 2.3 or 2.4 trillion of that is in U.S. dollars. That's not a very balanced portfolio. So do they want to get out of dollars and into yen, euros, gold, other types of things? Where's that tipping point? If they make that decision, what are the economic implications of that, not only for the United States, but what would be the economic implications of that for China? Now, there's a group of economists who would say, these are not issues. These are basically non-issues because all this borrowing and lending internationally is all done on voluntary terms. The Chinese are acquiring dollar-denominated assets. Nobody's forcing them to do that. But conditions that they've made in China have suggested that they are willing to continue to accumulate dollar-denominated assets. Similarly, for the United States, again, we're buying more than people are willing to buy from us. We're buying from foreigners more than people are willing to buy from us. So that, and again, these are voluntary transactions. The other side of that story is, yes, even voluntary transactions, though, can have adverse consequences if they become incredibly unbalanced. Question? Okay, so the question was, suppose we defaulted on our debt, and so notice if we default on our sovereign debt, two things happen, right? Budget deficits change, and trade deficits change, since the rest of the world's buying about a third of our sovereign, new sovereign debt issues every year. So other than... So what are the consequences of doing that other than higher interest rates? It depends. So, for instance, if you're Argentina, it's not only do you the issue for Argentina is not only are they paying higher interest rates, their net borrowing from the rest of the world over the last 10 years has been zero because nobody's willing to lend to them. So if you can't borrow from foreigners or from domestics, yes, your interest rates go up. But if you're talking about budget deficits, remember, budget deficits have to be financed. So we finance budget deficits by either increasing the bonds outstanding, borrowing, or by increasing the money supply. So if you can't borrow... and the central bank is independent and is not going to increase the money supply, monetize the debt, now your budget deficit has to come down significantly. So you have fiscal austerity. This is a situation that's happened in Europe, right? The ECB controls the money supply, so Greece and Ireland and Italy and Spain and Portugal don't have any ability to increase their own money supply, so they're stuck with... having to issue bonds at very high interest rates, which, by the way, increases their debt-to-GDP ratios. And if they don't want to do that, they need to reduce their government spending and end up with collapsing economies. So if you can't borrow, if you've been borrowing a lot, now all of a sudden nobody's willing to lend to you anymore, you can have some very significant issues. Okay, there are lots of other areas that economists disagree on. Which I'm not going to go into, but what I've tried to give you is kind of the polar extremes in terms of where we have widespread agreement, but also what the most contentious issues are. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons some of the issues, there are still so many contentious issues, has to do with a number of items in general about macroeconomics. The first is, we need to keep in mind that the economy is an incredibly complex system. And our understanding of that system is still quite incomplete. And it's incomplete for a variety of reasons. One is, it's a very complex system. We just don't understand everything about its structure or its dynamic mechanisms yet. And part of the reason we don't understand it better than what we do is that the data that we have is not always as good as it should be. In fact, much of the data that we have doesn't even match what our theoretical definitions of some of this data actually is. So to give you an example, we always talk about in the solo model or even in the saving and investment model, and it's important in the IS curve too, we have this thing that we call investment, right? And investment applies to the capital stock. But indeed, if you looked at our data, one of the things that you would see is, yeah, we have this big thing called capital I, private domestic investment. Well, shouldn't we add to that the government investment? I mean, when the government builds a road, that's part of the capital stock. That's really an investment. Shouldn't we count that as an investment? How about expenditures for education? Is building human capital an investment or is it a consumption expenditure? We actually count it as a consumption expenditure. Should it be? Don't know. So the data doesn't always match what our theoretical concept is. And as I mentioned earlier, even if it did, we don't have all that much data. We've got about 70 years worth of data. We haven't seen lots of extreme events during that period of time. So we don't know how the data or the economy would perform under stress events. And so we have a data set that doesn't really, it's not rich or robust enough to really allow us to make fine distinctions between theoretical arguments. Like, how sticky are wages and prices? Do we actually have nominal wage rigidities? In order to know whether you have nominal wage rigidities, you actually have to have had some period of time where they should have shown up or not. And we just simply haven't had that many different experiences. So we've got lots of things that are going on in the economy that we're learning more and more about, but we're not yet at the point where the major disagreements can be settled. And in fact, until we have more extreme events, I'm not sure that we'll ever get there. Okay, let me talk about the final exam for just a few minutes. So, as I said on Tuesday, our final exam is scheduled for Monday, May 7th from 3 to 6 p.m. So you'll have 3 hours to take the exam. We'll be in 220 and 230 Hearst Gym. The format of the exam will look just like the formats that you've seen on previous exams. There will be 10 multiple choice questions, and there will be 2 free response questions. So I can already tell you that one of the free response questions will have to do with the investment savings model. The other one will have to do with something about solo and whatever that solo model thing is. Okay? So those are our the 2 free response questions. So if you thought about the material, that's what we've seen in chapters 4, parts of 5, 6, and 7, right? So again, the exam itself is non-cumulative, but remember, macroeconomics is. So if you've forgotten everything that you knew that we've done earlier, you might have a little bit of trouble. Okay, so iClicker points. So let me talk a little bit about iClicker points. So hopefully I'll answer all the questions you might have. So we had a total of 459 points. So we had 23 days, 22 of which we had 20 points, and one day for some reason that I don't understand, we only had 19. So remember what we say is we're going to take iClicker points out of 80% of the total to account for absences, broken iClickers, brain freezes, all those kinds of things. So 80% of 459 is 367 points. So we add up all the points that you scored, divide by 367, change that to a percentage. The maximum you can get is 100%. So that will be your iClicker scores. I will calculate all of those sometime next week and post those on BSpace so you can see exactly what that looks like. I would ask that you double check all your problem set and exam scores up to this point. Make sure that what's on BSpace is in fact what you think you have on your piece of paper. If there's a discrepancy, take your problem set or your exam to your GSI first to get that corrected. If for some reason that can't happen, bring your problem set or exam to the final exam. You can give it to me and I can take care of it there. So once all the exams are graded for all the discussion sections, we will post final exam scores, weighted average, based on the weights that we have. Course letter grades will all show up in BSpace, and course letter grades, of course, will also go to Bearfax. Keep in mind that for course letter grades, those will be determined by GSI, not for the entire class. So your competition is against the other people in your discussion sections. Okay, folks, that's it. Thanks for a great class. We'll see you on the 7th. Thank you.